Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Why all the good cheer on Wall Street today? Well, the long-lost American housing market showed signs of life this morning. The AT&T T-Mobile deal, however, is dead. And our series Economy 4.0 returns from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 20th of December. Good as always to have you with us. From the Commerce Department this morning came these glad tidings. Construction of new homes and permits for new projects rose last month, the highest they've been in 18 months. In particular, developers went crazy building multifamily homes, apartment buildings, and the like. There is a growing market, in fact, of more people from the same family deciding to live under the same roof. Sarah Gardner reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
Chino, California, 40 miles east of L.A. To many Angelenos, it's a faceless exurb filled with cookie-cutter homes and smelly dairy farms. But to others, it's big houses on big lots at reasonable prices. And Greg McGuff, a division president at Lennar Homes, is itching to sell some freshly built houses here.
Craftsman, Tuscan, prairie-style architecture. You see a lot of rock and a lot of stone and exposed timber and beam.
Never mind the timber and beam. What's novel about this development are four models Lennar is testing out called next-gen homes, as in generations living together under one roof.
Either the boomerang kids coming back to live with their parents or the parents living with their parents or the sandwich generation where you have the children, the parents, and the grandparents all living in one location.
Nearly 20% of Americans now live like that. This doubled-up phenomenon accelerated during the recession, and it's prompted builders like Lennar to go beyond the time-worn casita or finished basement. Lennar's design in Chino is a 3,300-square-foot home. 600 of that is a semi-private suite with its own entrance. Boomerangs and grandparents, step right in.
The reservation you have of, I'm coming home and my mother-in-law's on my couch, that isn't the case. Your mother-in-law is on her own couch.
So family togetherness with an out. That's what Edward, a 33-year-old Chino resident, was thinking when he bought one of these houses. We bumped into him right afterward.
It's something that I've never seen before. You know, we like it.
Edward says yes, he wants to live with his in-laws. In fact, he and his wife asked them to move in with them, partly so they can pool their resources in a bad economy.
You share the costs and, you know, the help that, you know, we have with, you know, with the kids and building the relationships that are really, you know, important, I think, in life.
Lennar is testing these multi-generational homes in Arizona, California, and Nevada, notably in cities with a lot of Asian and Hispanic immigrants who are more apt to live with grandparents. But sales associate Gail Strickland says she talked to potential buyers who want the space for unemployed relatives and boomerang kids as well. Or in one couple's case, for the husband.
He was like, oh my gosh, this is perfect. And he's truly going to use that space just to have his own man cave.
Other builders are testing out their own versions of multi-generational housing. They see it as a niche market that could kickstart sales in an anemic economy. Real estate consultant Patrick Duffy.
About 20% of builders think it's the greatest thing ever. They want to jump right on it. You have another 20% of builders say it will never happen. And then the rest are sort of wait and see. And this tends to be a wait and see industry.
Gary Painter, director of the Lusk Center for Real Estate at USC, isn't convinced builders will find much of a market for these kinds of homes beyond Asians and Latinos, especially once the economy recovers.
The research suggests that, you know, these young adults, once they find jobs, once they feel secure about the jobs that they have, will likely go back to sort of normal living arrangements.
But Lennar's Greg McDuff says that still leaves the waves of retiring baby boomers. As they live longer and medical and assisted living costs rise, family togetherness, he argues, may begin to sound not sentimental, but economical. In Chino, California, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, best day all month. Enough said. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. After teasing us yesterday, Republicans in the House made good on their threats over the payroll tax cut today. They voted down the Senate's two-month extension of the tax break and of unemployment benefits. We were sitting around this morning trying to figure out a way to cover this story that wasn't just who did what to whom. So here's what we did. We called up some small business owners, and we played them this piece of tape. It's Speaker of the House John Boehner yesterday laying out what has been the Republicans' stated reason for voting no.
A two-month extension creates uncertainty and will cause problems for people who are trying to create jobs in the private sector.
And then we asked the business owners whether that was true.
My name is Tim Reynolds. I own Tribute Incorporated. We're a software development firm in Hudson, Ohio. I think that it's an example of the of uncertainty that Congress in general, and for that matter, the administration, has created over the last several years. And I think he's right that a two-month extension is essentially meaningless, both to employees and to employers. I don't know what the answers are, and I'm not particularly partisan. I think the political finger-pointing is very childish. I'd like to knock heads, you know, and say, okay, sit in a room and figure it out.
My name is Vicki Honeyman. I own a gallery gift shop in Ann Arbor, Michigan called Heavenly Metal. I actually am the main employee. I do everything. And then I have a handful of part-time people. All of the uncertainty in Washington is hard for small businesses because we're at the bottom of the feeding pool. And all of these decisions, especially what affects us tax-wise, what allows us to either hire or lay off people or invest more money into our businesses, is so much determined by how Congress and the Senate votes. So it's frightening, absolutely.
My name is Peter Rossing. I own Muse Art and Design in Portland, Oregon. We are a small art supply store. We have, in addition to myself, three employees. It's really not in my case. I mean, as a small business owner, I stick to my plans and what I need to do to serve my customers and keep my employees going, sort of regardless of really immediate uncertainty or changes.
Back to Vicki Honeyman in Ann Arbor, Michigan for just a second. Forget tax policy, she told me. What she really needs this time of year, Congress just can't give.
Well, we need it to snow. Seriously, tomorrow's supposed to be close to 50, and in order to get people out really in the Christmas mood, we need winter weather.
All right, joining the tax cut extension in the pile of things left undone at year's end is AT&T's hoped-for merger with T-Mobile. Would have been a $39 billion deal, but for AT&T walking away yesterday in the face of Justice Department opposition. AT&T was so confident this thing would go through, in fact, that they promised a $4 billion breakup fee to T-Mobile's parent company, Deutsche Telekom, if the whole thing went kerflooey. And they spent millions of dollars on ads and lobbyists trying to make their case that this deal would be good for consumers and the American economy. So with that kind of confidence going in, why didn't AT&T get its way? From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura has the story.
When a deal like this one is announced, lobbyists don't waste time. George Foote is a telecom lawyer with the firm Dorsey & Whitney, and he says AT&T's team is legendary.
Their in-house people are so well-respected, and they're so well-connected, and they've been so involved for so long in Washington that you can be sure that they touched every possible base.
The Justice Department, the Federal Communications Commission, Capitol Hill, and AT&T also hired outside help, former congressmen, former White House officials. And the company ran ads.
It's the AT&T network, and we're planning to combine with T-Mobile to deliver a better, stronger network, adding thousands of new cell sites to deliver better service and the most advanced mobile broadband experience.
But Foote says even lobbying has its limits.
Sometimes the legal principles and the economic forces that you're trying to take on are just too great.
Regulators and lawmakers were concerned about what this deal would do. Robert Frieden teaches law at Penn State. He says there would have been Verizon, AT&T, and not much else.
Nobody wants to see a duopoly controlling 85-90% of the marketplace.
Sprint fought the merger, so did consumer advocates. Frieden says regulators are starting to take a harder line.
If you're going to buy out a competitor, you've got to make some very compelling arguments and use empirical proof to show that you're not harming the marketplace and you're not harming consumers.
And that may make it harder for mega deals like this one to get approved. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Most hospitals in this country are considered not-for-profit, and there's kind of a deal implied. They get tax breaks, federal, local property, it adds up. And in return, they do charity care, treating the poor that for-profit hospitals might not care for. But it's not so simple, as Marketplace's Gregory Warner reports from the Health Desk at WHYY.
Last summer, Holly Lang did an experiment. She took uninsured people to 34 not-for-profit hospitals and asked about financial assistance.
And we were just shut down.
Only two hospitals gave her the info required by law. Lang runs the Hospital Accountability Project for Georgia Watch. She says tax-exempt hospitals need to do better.
They're not paying local property taxes. They're not paying, you know, certain income and sales tax. And so we need them to truly act in that community manner.
Nationwide, about half of tax-exempt hospitals spend just a fraction of their budget, 1.5%, on free and discounted medical care. That's according to a survey of hospital tax returns by the magazine Modern Healthcare. Republican Senator Chuck Grassley co-wrote a bill that made hospitals report that data to the IRS for the first time. It was an amendment to the healthcare reform law.
But I think these organizations still need to do a lot more in exchange for generous tax benefits.
Tom Getson is a health economist with Temple University. He says the new IRS definition of charity care doesn't include all the things that hospitals do and don't get paid for, like when uninsured people don't pay their bills, or community outreach programs that help seniors and the mentally ill and unmarried pregnant women.
Those things, they're usually not big money winners. They're money drains. And those are some of the kinds of community benefits that we expect an excellent community-oriented hospital to be doing.
And for now, there's no way for government to measure that. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
For those who haven't been in a modern public school classroom lately, there have been some changes since the days when you had to whack the erasers together after class to clean them out. Those chalkboards have been replaced not just by whiteboards, but by high-tech smart boards. Students are using laptops and iPads all over the place. In all, public schools spend roughly $3 billion a year on education technology, things meant to make teaching faster and easier and, in the end, better. Change can be hard, but companies are trying to ease the transition. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR, Amy Scott reports.
In a fifth-grade classroom at D.C. Bilingual Public Charter School in Washington, students break into small groups to study math. One group guesses the dimensions of an imaginary doghouse.
Who had the dimensions?
Another group tackles area and perimeter.
So what can you say about the size of a square?
And one boy sits on his own, wearing headphones, watching a video on a tablet computer. He's learning how to solve two-digit multiplication problems
using the partial products method together.
The video is on a website called LearnZillion. It has hundreds of free 5-minute math lessons for grades 3 to 9. A voice, that young-sounding teacher you just heard, explains how to solve problems as illustrations appear on a whiteboard. 10-year-old Danny Portillo follows along with a pencil and paper.
Now, I want you to stop the video and see if you can do it by yourself.
A few other students have been struggling with decimals. Instead of meeting with them individually or just moving on, teacher Jacqueline Vivolo sets them up on LearnZillion. She can create a custom playlist of online lessons for each student and track their progress.
It allows us to be in more places at once and also be able to help and support the students that are working on different content at the same time.
Customizing learning has been the holy grail in education for decades.
Tom Carroll is president of the nonprofit National Commission on Teaching and America's Future.
We have a much more diverse student population than we've ever had before. Diverse in learning backgrounds, skills, languages.
LearnZillion is among a handful of sites aiming to meet those different needs. You may have heard of the Khan Academy, a repository of free online videos on all kinds of subjects. Eric Westendorf is one of LearnZillion's founders. He's former principal at E.L. Haynes Public Charter School in D.C. Westendorf says what distinguishes LearnZillion's videos is that they're made by teachers.
I knew that there were so many folks out there who had figured out over time ways of explaining things really clearly that really worked. And we wanted to tap into that expertise out there.
Teachers can tap that expertise to see how other teachers teach. Andrea Smith teaches sixth grade math at E.L. Haynes.
If I had had this when I started teaching, I think it would have saved me a lot of time and a lot of probably trial and error on my students.
Parents can also use the free videos to brush up. Don't tell me you remember how to determine the end behavior of a polynomial function.
The company plans to make money by charging parents a small fee to follow their kids' progress and by selling extra services to schools. It pays teachers $100 for each video they make. Judith Haymore-Sandholtz is a professor of education at the University of California, Irvine. She says even good videos can't replace the interaction between a live teacher and student.
The bottom line is that this doesn't give you access to students' thinking. And if students have misconceptions along the way, you need to have an approach that will allow you a window into their thinking.
LearnZillion has quizzes so teachers can see what students have learned. Advocates of instructional videos say they give teachers more time to interact with students. With the basic lessons covered, teachers can focus on helping students learn to apply them. In Washington, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up, 'tis the season, maybe.
My family always was more the type of family that would be saying things like, well, you don't need a gift, do you? I mean, we don't need to get presents. We love each other, right?
Yeah, how'd that work out? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials packed on 337 points today, 2.8%, ended at 12,103. The NASDAQ up 80 points, 3.1%. Finished at 2603. The S&P 500 rose 35 points, nearly 3%, closed at 1241. Home builders benefited. Pulte Group added on 10%. Lennar built up more than 6% today, and banks regained their footing as well. Bank of America walked up 3.7%. So too did Goldman Sachs. AT&T lost 0.5% after abandoning its deal with T-Mobile. Competitors mopped up. Sprint advanced more than 9% today. Dish Network also dished up more than 9%. There is some speculation AT&T might try to buy the second largest U.S. satellite TV company to expand its wireless spectrum. Prices for the 10-year T-note fell. The yield rose to 1.92%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Wednesday. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for November. The shopping, wrapping, and shipping countdown continues. Tomorrow is the last day to send priority mail via U.S. Post for Christmas arrival. And maybe you've done her workout. Actress Jane Fonda turns 74. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Kodak shares closed at a somewhat amazing 67 cents today. The company that was once the name in photography clearly isn't anymore. In fact, it's restructuring to stave off a bankruptcy that analysts say could come sooner rather than later. And if I might crib from Paul Simon for a moment, it was digital photography that took the Kodachrome away. Kodak made a huge mistake in business strategy about 30 years ago. But it's one that does hold some lessons for the future of jobs in this country. Our series Economy 4.0 is all about how to make the global economy work better for more people. So we sent Marketplace's David Brancaccio to the capital of Kodak, Rochester, New York, to have a look around.
What got me launched on this story was a former Treasury secretary comparing Kodak to Apple. Writing in the Financial Times, Larry Summers had pointed out that Apple Computer does not create all that many good factory jobs, and many are overseas. But Eastman Kodak gave Rochester, quote, a thriving middle class for two generations, actually for even longer, until things began to unravel.
When I started there in 1980, there were 62,000 people. Now there's less than 7,000 people.
Art Frisbee is talking Kodak jobs in Rochester. He worked for 27 years in a mill making photo paper. Today, tidy grass is planted where many a factory facility once stood in massive Kodak Park.
It's a ghost town.
While Kodak knocked down so many of its factory buildings, the delightful houses that encircle Kodak Park are still there.
This is the Maplewood section.
Professor Carolyn Vaca is the official historian for Monroe, the local county.
You can see the tree-lined streets, the lovely homes with the gracious front porches.
This is pretty upscale. Is this where the top executives of Eastman Kodak would have lived?
No, this is what people who worked hard at Kodak but weren't, you know, managers or anything, could afford, could live in, and could raise their families.
Founder George Eastman wanted workers to have decent lives. He had a paternalistic streak a mile wide. Plus, it was strategic. Eastman knew success requires a critical mass of loyal employees innovating and sharing good ideas.
You do find these circles of thought forming. And Eastman was one who promoted that kind of circles of thought, particularly where he lived, inviting people in to talk about things, almost like a salon.
It's a reason Bob Harris wanted to work for Kodak. He's retired now, but back when he started in the 50s, there was a decent shot it would be a job for life.
Let's see, after about 2 years at Kodak, I bought a house. You go into a bank, and they say, well, give us the information. Where do you work? I said, I work at Kodak. That's all I need to know.
Harris spent 35 years at the company, teaching and promoting photography to kids, grown-ups, even astronauts. One plum assignment, Harris got to demonstrate an early Kodak digital camera for passengers on a cruise.
And they loved to come back during cocktail hour and look at the images right there on the television set in the lounge on the cruise ship, but they just weren't interested in buying one.
Turns out Kodak actually invented what would become for the company a doomsday device, a digital camera prototype, back in 1975. But even pioneers can make mistakes. Kodak was used to making money on film, not cameras.
So Kodak decided, let's let the camera business go, and it went to Japan.
Willie Shih teaches at the Harvard Business School, but in 1997, he became head of Kodak's consumer digital unit, and it was his job to get his company back into the digital camera manufacturing business. But Professor Shih struck out.
With digital, there is no film. You make your money by selling cameras, and you now needed to make components. You needed to make lenses. You needed to make shutters, all kinds of things that the skills for which no longer existed in Rochester.
Because Kodak had let the equipment, the knowledge, the suppliers go somewhere else, they had unwittingly damaged what she calls the industrial commons. Think of it as a concentration of expertise. Silicon Valley has it, but parts of Rochester's industrial commons have gone fallow. And the question becomes, how do you replant it?
One of the things we as a country need to do is start thinking deeply about the capabilities that we want to have on our shores in the 21st century.
And not let those capabilities slip away with the good middle-class jobs. And while Shih is not a fan of the government picking winners and losers, he does like government investments in basic research and education. These could target America's industrial commons to restore them to the brilliance of a Kodachrome photo. In Rochester, New York, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
And now a little Marketplace holiday cheer. Think of it as our gift to you. Over the next couple of days, we're going to hear from writers and comedians about the holidays, people who use this time of year to come up with good material, or better yet, spread joy with their words. Up first, comedian Marc Maron.
The holidays have always been sort of a mildly depressing time because I wasn't brought up with that much holiday cheer. My family always was more the type of family that would be saying things like, well, you don't need a gift, do you? I mean, we don't need to get presents. We love each other, right? I think that people like to buy things, and I think that people like to receive gifts. I do, and I like to give gifts. So I've become wary of it because there's always the problem of buying the wrong gift. And I have a girlfriend now, and I don't know what I'm going to get her, but I got to get her something. And then there's that fear that you're going to get her the wrong thing, and she's going to pretend like she likes it. And then that causes problems that ultimately leads to divorce. Maybe I'm, again, looking too far into the future because we're not even married, but I think that people enjoy buying things, clearly, since our economy is driven by it. And I think so it makes sense that the economy's getting a bump. You know, it may not be on real money. It just shows me that there are still a few people in this country that can still get credit. I'd like a new car. I mean, not an extravagant car, but I think that's asking for too much. I like knitted hats. I like vinyl records. If anyone's out there a fan or likes me just from listening to me right now, maybe I should make a gift list at Amazon for people. I'm going to try to do my best to help the economy by buying a lot of presents. I'll buy several presents for one person in the hopes that one of them is really the right present. Do not give presents and then get mad at the person if they don't respond properly, because that'll just add the problems in this country. Try to be as selfless as possible when you're giving. And when you get something, pretend like you like it, but make sure you know where it came from so you can go get what you really want. But be nice. Be nice.
Be nice. Mark Maron is the host of the podcast WTF. Send us your stories. If you got them, marketplace.org is the website. Click on the link that says contact.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which I do believe qualifies as this week's sign, the apocalypse is upon us. My colleague John Moe noted this morning that we, collectively, all of us, watched a trillion YouTube videos this year. 1 trillion. That's 140 videos for every person on the planet, if all of us actually watched YouTube videos. But here's the thing. Of those 1,000 billion videos, this one was the most watched.
It's Friday, Friday, gotta get down on Friday. Everybody's looking forward to the weekend.
I don't know, Rebecca Black, Friday, I am collectively a little embarrassed for us, I gotta tell you. All right, that's Marketplace from, that's the first time I heard it, by the way. Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow packed on 337 points, 2.8%. The NASDAQ added 80 points, 3 1/10. The S&P 500 rose 35 points, nearly 3%. Thanks to Justin Ho, Ethan Lindsay, and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up here tomorrow, writing a Christmas episode is way not as easy as you think.
It's weird because I work with a lot of Jewish comedy writers, and I'm Hindu, so there's not one of us that's more qualified to write a Christmas episode. We're all kind of equally not qualified.
Our dose of holiday cheer continues with actress and writer Mindy Kaling. You know her from The Office on NBC, and you'll hear her here tomorrow. I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for it. This is APM, American Public Media.